From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty in for Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson, broadcasting today from NPR West in Culver City, California. It's Here and Now. A hotly contested congressional race in Georgia is heading to a runoff.
We are changing the world. And your voices are going to ring out across this state and across this country.
That's Democrat John Ossoff, who narrowly missed winning a seat outright last night in Georgia's traditionally conservative 6th District. The seat was previously held by Republican Tom Price, who resigned to become U.S. Secretary of Health and Human Services. And the race has been seen as an early measure for President Trump. Now, Ossoff will face Republican Karen Handel in a runoff in June. And joining us now is Bradley George of Here and Now contributor Georgia Public Broadcasting. Bradley, if John Ossoff had gotten more than 50% of the vote, he wouldn't have to go to this runoff. He would have won outright. That didn't happen. But how are he and the party responding today?
They're pretty jubilant, and they're confident that they can keep up this excitement that Ossoff has seen and continue that to this June 20th runoff. Ossoff was the early favorite in polling for this primary. There were 18 candidates in the primary. He was on top of that field. He raised over $8 million. That's more than certainly any other candidate. From the moment he jumped into this race, even though he was a relative unknown, he had the backing of party insiders, people like Congressman John Lewis, Congressman Hank Johnson, who Ossoff used to work for. And he's absolutely confident that he can keep that support and that excitement and that momentum going for the next couple of months.
And he was really close, by the way, to that 50% mark.
Yeah, he was. Just watching the returns coming in last night, he stayed over that 50% mark for a while. This district covers three counties in Atlanta and in the surrounding area: DeKalb, Fulton, and Cobb. DeKalb and Cobb counties had all their votes in pretty early. It took Fulton County a little while because there were some issues with the data cards that they used to collect and tabulate votes, and so it wasn't until later in the actually early this morning before Fulton County got its final numbers in. And Karen Handel and John Ossoff actually talked to their supporters before the outcome was known. That clip of Ossoff you played, he was talking about, well, we might pull it out tonight or it might go to the runoff, but either way, bring it on.
And it will go to the runoff. President Trump has been tweeting about the race. Yesterday, he wrote that he learned that Ossoff doesn't even live in the district that he wants to represent. Is that true? And does that hurt Ossoff?
Well, he lives just outside the district, I think not terribly far. It's not like he lives in another part of Georgia or another part of the country. He said he will move to the district if he's elected. I don't think it doesn't seem to have affected him so far, but you can count on Republicans to make hay of that. And speaking of President Trump, he was tweeting about it again this morning, just looking at his feed here. He said, despite major outside money, fake media support, and 11 Republican candidates, he called it a big R win with the runoff in Georgia. He says it's now Hollywood versus Georgia in the June 20th runoff.
Well, let's talk about the Republican Karen Handel. She spoke last night as the results came in. Here she is.
So let's celebrate, then get some sleep, and hit the ground running tomorrow so that on June 20th, we keep the 6th District red and kick a little Ossoff.
So tell us about her and how close she is to President Trump.
Okay, first of all, I have to say kick a little Ossoff is actually a play on a slogan that John Ossoff has been using. He has signs that says, vote your Ossoff. Anyway, Karen Handel, she is the former Georgia Secretary of State. She's tried to run for some other offices. She tried to run for governor in 2010 and didn't make it out of the GOP primary. She also considered a run for the U.S. Senate back in 2014. She emerged as the Republican frontrunner in this crowded field. There were a couple of other well-known GOP figures in there as well. People outside Georgia might know her from her tenure as a vice president at Susan G. Komen for the Cure, and she was part of this effort that the Komen group had to cut its ties with Planned Parenthood in 2012. That was a hugely controversial decision. Komen soon reversed it after it was announced, and Handel resigned from the group. But she's somebody who's been an old hand in Georgia politics for a while.
Was this race, do you think, up until this point, all about President Trump?
It's interesting because John Ossoff kind of had this duality with some of his campaign rhetoric. He talked about – I interviewed him briefly for a piece I did for you all last week, just previewing this race. And he said that this is a race about local issues, and it's about an economic message and bringing more high-tech jobs to this district. But at the same time, he talked about being a check on President Trump and holding President Trump accountable. You look at Trump's approval rating in this district. There was a poll that came out last week that showed that among voters in the 6th district that it's evenly split. So certainly Democrats are happy to make this a referendum on Trump.
That's Bradley George of Here and Now contributor Georgia Public Broadcasting. Bradley, thank you.
Thanks, Jeremy.
Well, what does the Georgia race mean for the Democratic Party as a whole? The party's been soul-searching ever since Democrats lost last year's presidential election. And Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders and the recently elected chairman of the Democratic National Committee, Tom Perez, kicked off a tour this week in traditionally red states called Come Together, Fight Back. Here's Sanders in Louisville, Kentucky last night.
So our job is to take the progressive message out into the world, to go beyond our zone of comfort, to start talking to working people and say, do you really believe, you who voted for Donald Trump, do you really believe that America needs tax breaks for billionaires and cuts in Medicare and Medicaid and education? And I think people will say, no, that's not why I voted for Trump. But we have a lot of work to do.
Here and Now political analyst Jamal Simmons joins us now. He's a Democratic strategist. Hi there, Jamal.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well. Well, first of all, so let's just talk about Georgia here for a second. I mean, it could be an exciting moment for Democrats, but on the other hand, Ossoff raised, what, more than four times the amount of money from his next closest candidate? So, you know, how much excitement should there be?
Democrats should be excited for a couple of reasons. One, I've lived in Georgia and did a lot of work in Georgia. It's really sort of my political home. The district that he came up in is a district where the last Republican who held that seat had about 23-point advantage over the last Democrat. So just getting to 48%, and then you add in the other Democrats who ran, that'll get you about 49%, is very good sign, even if he doesn't win, because what it says is we are lifting Democrats' floors up all over the place. And the more time and money and effort we spend to build the Democratic floor and base, that means that statewide, you're going to have a lot more luck.
I mean, the counter reading to that, though, is that, you know, 95% of the, what, $8+ million that Ossoff raised came from out of state, and he still couldn't get over 50%.
Hey, it doesn't matter where the money comes from. You still got to pay the TV stations don't take credit cards, as my friend Robert Gibbs used to say.
But he still couldn't get over the 50%, even though he had, you know, more than $8 million. That's what I'm saying.
But this is what I'm saying, which is even if I think he can get over 50%, but even if he doesn't get over 50%, it's good for Democrats because it means you're lifting the floor up. And sometimes you don't want to lose. Losing by 23 points, it's better to lose by 2 points than it is to lose by 23 points, because that means you are lifting the floor for all Democrats statewide. In a state like Georgia, where you have a governor's race coming up at some point in 2020, you'll have a presidential race. You want Democrats losing districts by small numbers. I know it sounds counterintuitive to say that's important, but if you look at the statewide totals, it's much better that way.
Okay, so let's talk about, let's take a step back here and talk about the party as a whole. I mean, it's still facing this central problem. I mean, who is making up the Democratic coalition? What's the soul of the party right now?
Well, yeah, and one more thing on the Ossoff. There are 71 to maybe 90 more districts who have better Democratic performance than the district that he ran in. So you could actually see if he's at 48% in that district, Democrats in other places with better numbers should do better. As to whose party it is, I would say the Democratic Party is now a more progressive party than it used to be. I came up in the Clinton era. I was raised by a lot of Clinton strategists. And those of us who were sort of third way, middle of the road, new Democratic kind of raised folks may be a little more uncomfortable with the kind of party that we're seeing. But the truth is, you've got to get Democratic ideological liberal advocates and activists out into the communities and voting so that those of us who are in the center can then make the difference in an election day. But you've got to get that kind of energy from the left.
Okay, so then I'm wondering how this tweet today from President Trump sort of resonates, because he says, of course, his tweet, he said, Dems failed in Kansas and are now failing in Georgia. It is now Hollywood versus Georgia on June 20th. And I'm wondering, I mean, isn't that still a potent message? message coming from Republicans, coming from President Trump, that isn't necessarily the way Democrats want to define themselves. But that message resonates with working class voters, for example.
It could be potent from someone like Johnny Isaacson or maybe even Mike Pence. I think Donald Trump is a particular person who has his own negatives, and so people may be discounting what it is he says. I mean, look, he told us that a carrier was headed toward North Korea that we found out was in Indonesia. So I'm not sure he has the most credibility when it comes to listening to what the president says.
Oh, well, he may continue to have strong credibility amongst his base, though. But in the last couple
right, and so listen, it's base versus base. And I thought this in the course of the campaign against Hillary Clinton. Donald Trump is very good at advocating and getting his base to move. Democrats have to get better at getting our base to move, and it's a base versus base fight, and you've got to do better as Democrats to win that war.
I'm giving you a 10-second chance here to tell us what you think about Republican Congressman Jason Chaffetz of not running for re-election in Utah.
Well, you know, Utah is a state that it's going to be, it's a pretty Republican, reliable Republican red state. So we'll see what happens. I don't expect this to be a pickup opportunity for the Democrats.
Jamal Simmons, Democratic strategist and Here and Now political analyst. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Can a mother forgive her child's murderer? Well, Alyssa Parker did. In 2012, her 6-year-old daughter Emily was one of the 20 children and 6 adults killed by Adam Lanza at Sandy Hook Elementary School. And in her new book, An Unseen Angel, Parker takes us on her journey of devastation, of faith, and how she found a way to forgive her daughter's killer. Alyssa joins us now. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you for having me.
I wonder if you could just tell us a little story that you tell in the early pages of the book about how that day began. It began with Emily just crawling into bed with you and being a luminous little girl. Can you tell us that story?
Yeah. So my husband had left for work already, and I was just in bed by myself. And, you know, she crawled up, and I opened my eyes, and she was just there and so beautiful. And we chatted for a little bit, and I remember thinking, oh, I don't want to move. I don't want to get up, but we got to get ready. And so we went into her room, and she just had this most amazing thing that she had discovered. And on the back of the bed, we had stenciled these flowers, and they were her 3 favorite colors, black and pink and blue. And she said, Mom, I have the coolest thing to show you. And I said, what? And she said, look at these flowers. Do you see these 2 flowers? She said, one has a pink center with a black outside, and the other one is pink with a black inside. Do you see it? And I said, yeah. She said, they're connected. Isn't that amazing? There's connections everywhere. Do you see it? And those words were so profound to me in the months and the years since her passing, seeing these connections and the connections everywhere. And I hear those words in the voice every time, you know, I have one of those small little miracles. And I think, do you see the connections, Mom? Mm. They're everywhere.
That's the magic and the wonder of little kids, isn't it? I mean, they're sort of prophetic without even knowing it.
Right.
Alyssa, I'm sorry to have to ask you to share some of these memories from the days and weeks after Emily died, but you do write about them so bravely in the book. I mean, mm-hmm. What was the immediate aftermath like?
I just couldn't get out of bed, and that it was so difficult to be a mother all of a sudden. And the things that came so natural to me now felt impossible to do, just my day-to-day life. I had this innate motherly instinct to always keep track of, you know, all 3 of my kids, and holding hands was something that, you know, was a part of my job, and it was really difficult after she died. I would scramble to make sure everyone was holding a hand and somehow connecting to me as we crossed the street to recognize that there was one missing. And her hands in particular, I remember such detail about her hands. And my little girls, her sisters, it was really painful when I would hold their hands. I missed her. I missed just connecting with her in that way.
Mm. I mean, there's nothing I feel that could ever replace that singular feeling of the warmth and uniqueness mm-hmm. of their little palm in yours.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, given that, losing a child is like getting your soul ripped out from you. There's nothingness. There's blackness after that.
And yeah.
I ask that because, I mean, a big part of the story that you write in the book is the fact that you and your family are Mormons, so faith is central to your life. Was there a moment after, or moments after Emily passed away, that you just said, God, how could you have let this happen?
You know, I never really responded that way, and I don't know why. I wasn't desperate to blame him. I was desperate to get answers from him.
You write in the book that I trusted God and knew in my heart he was not my opponent. Rather, he could be my comforter. Mm-hmm. So how did you feel that comfort?
I felt it almost immediately after I found out that Emily died. I remember sitting in my car with my husband, Robbie, and that was the first time we really had been alone. And it was quiet. And he decided to say a prayer. And while he was saying the prayer, I immediately heard words run through my mind. And it said that Emily was okay and that everything our family needed to get through this would be provided for. And though the moment was very brief, I felt hope. And after the prayer was over, again, I was swarmed with this grief and shock, and that hope did not last in that moment very long. But over the course of the next few days especially, I looked back on that and wondered, how is he going to fulfill that promise to me? How is he going to see this through? Because right now, the only thing that would see me through would be having my daughter come back.
Yeah. Well, you write in the book, though, Alyssa, about how after a while you do begin to see your way through. And then something incredible happens. You decided that you needed to meet with Peter Lanza, father of the shooter who took your daughter's life. I mean, how did you come to that realization?
You have to understand, when the shooting happened, the last thing I was really thinking about was my feelings and emotions towards the shooter. I was angry. He was a monster to me. And I felt okay with that for the time being. I felt like holding on to that anger was something I deserved,
yeah.
That I was supposed to feel those feelings. And it wasn't until my husband shared with me an interaction that he had with our daughter, Madeline. When he was tucking her in for bed, she said, "When do I get to see Emily again?" And he said, "You know, when we are here on this earth, if we make good choices, when we die, we'll be able to see Emily again." And she thought about that for a minute and then said, "What about the boy who shot Emily? What happens to him?" And so my husband posed the question to her, "Well, what do you think God thinks of him?" And her response was, "I think that God still loves him, but is really sad about the choices that he made." And it wasn't until he spoke those sweet words to me that I considered looking at him through different eyes. That conversation led us to have a meeting with the shooter's father.
I suppose in meeting Peter Lanza, you were also sitting across the table from another parent who had who had experienced a horrible loss.
And I thought to myself, you know, this is a man who's also lost his son, but lost him in a horrific way, where his son has created so much damage. And I had a lot of empathy.
I am amazed by your empathy, to be perfectly honest, because...
Right.
But I'm thinking back to, Alyssa, how you said that it never occurred to you to blame God, but did you want to hold Peter Lanza more accountable?
What I felt was, and I thought about all of those children who struggle with something similar, and their parents who are desperately trying to find answers and find help for their child. And if I isolate this father and I make him feel horrible for the mistakes that he made, I felt like I was turning that finger and pointing it at those parents who were struggling with the exact same thing. And that did not seem at all like the Christ-like thing to do. I want to learn from what went wrong and see what we can do to make sure that this doesn't happen again.
Yeah. Do you mind if I ask you to read a little excerpt from your book?
Of course. I would never fathom what was in his heart, but God could. God knew how to hold him accountable. God knew how to judge him. That burden was not for me to carry. Rather, it was for me to lay down at God's feet. It was not something I needed to grapple with the rest of my life. I didn't have to judge. I didn't have to figure it out. As I made this decision, a burden so deep and so heavy it nearly crushed me was physically lifted from me. My heart burned with a joy so powerful it brought me to tears. I had learned it was possible to forgive Adam Lanza, and that first step was for me to choose to simply let it go.
That's Alyssa Parker reading an excerpt from her book, An Unseen Angel. Did it really feel like that? Like suddenly you could breathe again a little bit?
Yeah, it truly did. And what was so interesting was when I could physically feel that weight lifted off and that peace instantly replaced it, I knew that that's what Emily wanted for me.
Yeah. That's the thing about forgiveness, right? It's not just an act that you bestow on someone else.
No,
right?
No, not at all.
It's something that profoundly heals you. It's almost as if you're doing it for yourself.
And honestly, there's days that I fail. There's days that I don't have that feeling in my heart, but I get better at it and I get stronger and it gets easier. But I was so grateful that that transition, that transformation allowed me to be a mom again.
Yeah. Well, Alyssa Parker's book is An Unseen Angel. She's also a national advocate and lecturer for school safety through Safe and Sound Schools. Alyssa, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you.
This Here and Now podcast is sponsored by ZipRecruiter, making it quick and easy to find quality candidates. Instantly post your job to over 100 job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. Plus, get access to over 6 million resumes. Select, screen, and rate candidates with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard and find the right hire fast. Find out why ZipRecruiter has been used by Fortune 100 companies and thousands of small and medium-sized businesses. Get started for free today at ziprecruiter.com/here.
On Sunday, the first round of voting begins in France's presidential election. A runoff between the top two vote-getters will be held next month. And one of the key issues in the campaign has been the country's sluggish economy. France is Europe's third biggest economy, but it also has one of the slowest growth rates in the European Union. Maggie Lake hosts CNN Money with Maggie Lake. She's in New York and joins us. Hi, Maggie.
Hi, Jeremy.
And what is the state of the French economy right now?
The French economy is stuck in stall speed. Growth's only about 1.5%. Government debt levels are high. And perhaps most worrying, and it's something I've been watching really closely, unemployment has been stuck near 10% for years now. And for young people, it's 24%. That is incredibly high.
And the top two candidates in the race are Marine Le Pen on the far right National Front and Emmanuel Macron, who is a former economic minister and banker. They have very different visions for the economy in France. What is each proposing?
Yeah, very different visions. Macron has been described as an independent centrist, and what we might call here socially liberal but pro-business, right? He's in favor of open markets, open borders. He wants, importantly, to keep France in the European Union. He supports free trade, and he's proposed some reforms, cutting corporate taxes, reforming that 35-hour work week they're so attached to. And it's worth putting out, he's really young, too, 39 years old. Le Pen is much more radical and more to the far right and more controversial, I think it's fair to say. She wants to take France out of the European Union, scrap the euro, reinstate borders. She's very anti-immigration. That's really been the center of her platform. And she wants to, what she says, protect French jobs and French businesses. I mean, they really have a very, very different worldview from each other.
And she says she wants to hold a referendum on France's membership in the EU, which brings us to the comparison with the country across the English Channel.
Yeah.
I mean, before Brexit, nobody really gamed out what was going to happen to Britain, to the economy, to Europe, if Brexit actually went through, because a lot of people did not believe that it would happen. So let's talk about Frexit. If France leaves the European Union, many people believe that would be the end of the EU. What would the consequences be and for the global economy?
I mean, it's hard to put into words, actually. I mean, it would be a radical change, a very negative shock to the system. Remember, Jeremy, the UK voted to leave, but they never adopted the euro. So that was sort of maybe a baby step. If France were to leave, one of the core European countries, no economist I've talked to or investor knows what that would look like. So many of these economies and supply chains are interconnected. The idea of going back to 28 different currencies, I don't think anyone could get their head around that. Now, I should point out, the markets are not pricing this scenario in right now. France has two rounds of voting and no poll currently shows Le Pen winning the second round. But my colleagues there have been going around the country tell me there are a lot of undecided voters. It's a record number in this election. And it's worth pointing out as well that a far left candidate, Jean-Luc Mélenchon, who's been quickly rising in the polls, he also favors a referendum on leaving the euro. So there is a lot of risk out there. And it's something investors, they're not pricing it in, but they're watching very nervously. And it would impact all of us. I mean, that would be a radical change, not only to the global economy, but the global financial system. And remember, way back in 2007, we found out what happens when one area implodes. It definitely affects all of us negatively.
And the markets don't always price in everything they should be. Maggie Lake.
And the polls aren't always accurate.
That's right. Maggie Lake of CNN Money. Thank you.
Thanks, Jeremy.
Yesterday, we heard from Dr. Caleb Alexander, the co-director of the Johns Hopkins Center for Drug Safety and Effectiveness, about his thoughts on combating the opioid crisis in this country. You can hear that interview at hereandnow.org. Today, we want to hear from a survivor, someone who was addicted to opioids and is now in recovery. Nick Roberts joins us by Skype from St. Albans, West Virginia. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
And start by telling us how your addiction started.
Well, I had a pretty all-American childhood, I guess you could say. I had a loving family. There was no traumatic event that sparked anything. If I could trace it back as early as I possibly can, I would say when I was about 12 years old, I had a minor surgery on my toe, and the doctor wrote me a prescription for some pretty heavy narcotic pain medicine. There was no need for me to be on this kind of medication for that amount of time. And I went home, and I was starting to feel a little bit of physical pain, so my mom gave me one of the pills. And this weird thing happened where not only did the physical pain go away, but that the mental feelings of inferiority and feeling less than kind of subsided as well. And I just remember that moment so clearly, as for the first time I imagined I felt like other people felt. I knew there was something out there that I could put into my body that would make me feel normal.
And how did you get it? How did you get that something that you needed to feel the way that you wanted to feel?
I was in high school, and I would experiment with marijuana and alcohol on the weekends. And then my focus kind of went away from sports, friends, school, to getting high, drinking as much as I could. And it quickly progressed from just marijuana and alcohol to pain pills, to cocaine. And then it progressed as far as finding a needle and doing things that I said I would never do to maintain my addiction.
How easy was it for you to get those things?
That's a tough question, because if I wanted a prescription of, say, opiates, it was a little more difficult to get it the legal route than it was to just call up a friend that I knew had some. So the system was working in that regard. I found no way to, as a young person who's relatively healthy, to abuse the doctor system that way. I went straight to the streets, and that's where I was most successful at getting pills.
Hmm. So how bad did it get before you decided to get into recovery?
Well, I lost my car, my apartment, and my girlfriend all in 1 week from one bad episode. And I ended up moving back in with my mom at age 25. And for about 3 months of living in her house, waking up every day just religiously at 4:30 in the morning, sick from withdrawals. And I hated my life. I wasn't going to end my life, but I didn't care if I died. And I remember my mom walked in one morning. I was laying there in bed, curled up, sick. And she sat down on the edge of the bed and looked at me and said, "Nick, I'm not going to watch you die in my house. You can either get out of my house or I will take you to treatment." And that ultimatum saved my life. If she hadn't have done that, I would have overdosed and died. I'm sure of that.
Hmm. So you needed that other person, really, in this case, your mom, to take you and bring you to where you needed to go.
I needed someone that cared enough about me that they would show tough love. I didn't have the mental clarity to say, "Hey, my life has spiraled completely out of control." I had to get slapped in the face by reality.
So what was that reality? What was the program? How did you manage to get over this addiction?
I remember very clearly the very first day that I got there to Recovery Point of Huntington. And I carried my suitcase back to the director's office and I sat down. And he said, "Just so you know, I was sitting right where you're at 5 years ago." And that just kind of went through me. I had been to treatment facilities before and been exposed to 12-step meetings and met with psychiatrists and psychologists, but I had never really sat down and talked with someone that had been where I was at and seemed to be successful, happy, living a normal life. He said, "What makes you, why should I give you a bed? We have a waiting list of 100 people literally dying to get in here. Why should you go first?" And I said, "My thinking is messed up." I don't know why I said that. I don't know how I had that clarity of mind to say that. But he smiled a little bit and he said, "We've got a bed for you." And they took me into detox, and that's where my recovery began on April 13th, 2012.
And you've been sober since then?
Yes, sir.
And what's it been like for you? Has it been difficult? Is it still difficult now to stay away from those drugs?
No, and I think that's part of the misconception a lot of people have, especially active addicts, is that we've bought into this image of a person in recovery as someone that is just white-knuckling it through the day to stay sober. They're just hanging on for dear life, and it's not like that at all. The first 3 weeks in recovery were pretty rough. I was mentally obsessing on using, was physically sick, but after those first 3 weeks, I started, you know, developing new habits. Through this program, we would go to classes and learn things about the effects of drugs on the brain and alcohol on liver enzymes and the history of AA and NA. And I was given a master's degree in myself, pretty much.
Hmm.
And it took that education and being exposed to real people in recovery who had done things much worse than I'd ever dreamed of. And somehow they were putting months together, years together without using. And the kicker was they seemed genuinely happy about it. And me today, 5 years sober, I'm married. I have a newborn daughter. I get to be a stepfather to a great young 8-year-old boy. I will graduate with my bachelor's degree in English this May. And I have a full-time job. And you could not tell me that I would have all these things and go through the day without even thinking about drugs and alcohol.
So what do you think would help other people do what you did? What do you think will solve the opioid crisis in this country?
That's a big question. I think a lot of people more smarter than I am need to come together and address it. But I think it starts with education. You know, if I just go by my own personal experience, the stigma of addiction has to be shattered. People have to realize that it is a disease. It was classified by the American Medical Association as a disease in 1985. And once we can kind of break this image of the addict being morally inferior, then people, I think, would be more prone to admit that they have a problem. And then it gets into step two of what we need to address, which is the availability of treatment. Unfortunately, when an addict finally asks for help, there is a very small window of opportunity for them to get help. That willingness quickly goes away. Unfortunately, in the state of West Virginia, we have many facilities, residential facilities for drug and alcohol rehabilitation, but they carry with them long waiting lists, particularly like Recovery Point of Huntington, which I went through, which you go through at no cost to the client. You can imagine how long a waiting list for a program like that would be.
Well, Nick Roberts, I just want to congratulate you on doing everything that you have done to get through this. It sounds like you've got a great life going now with your family there in West Virginia. So thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, and thank you very much for addressing this issue and being a part of the solution.
The Stanley Cup playoffs are underway, and television ratings-wise, the games are off to their best start ever, up 9% over last year. One reason for the uptick may be the growing popularity of the sport among immigrants from Asia and Latin America. Shigana Ahamparam is a reporter with Feet in Two Worlds, a project at the New School in New York that brings us stories by immigrant journalists to public radio. She grew up in a Sri Lankan family in hockey-crazed Toronto and went looking for other immigrants who have embraced the sport the way she has.
This is Hockey Night in Canada. That's right, Hockey Night in Canada Punjabi. In Canada, hockey is everywhere. I grew up in Toronto, where nearly half the population is immigrants, including my parents who came from Sri Lanka. The growing diversity in the fan base for this sport led the CBC to start broadcasting Hockey Night in Canada in additional languages other than the country's official English and French. I think of my brothers and me sitting in front of the TV almost every game night. No one was allowed to change the channel or leave the room while the puck was in play. It was a sacred ritual. My childhood best friend, Sharnia Jayaratnam, who's also of Sri Lankan descent and an absolute hockey fanatic, had her own game rituals as well.
I had to be home every Saturday night so I could watch Hockey Night in Canada, where I could watch the Toronto Maple Leafs play.
And on nights when the Leafs games were on TV channels they couldn't access...
My mom doesn't know the story. It would be me doing homework and listening to like 590 The Fan and like listening to the hockey game when I did homework on the radio with my headphones on.
When I came to the U.S., I was aware that hockey is not as popular here as, say, football or baseball. And compared with those sports, its fan base is decidedly not diverse. According to Nielsen's 2013 Year in Sports Media Report, 92% of the NHL fan base in the 2012-2013 regular season was white. Diversity is not a problem in the Ironbound section of Newark, New Jersey, a neighborhood known for its dense immigrant population and home to the city's oldest ice rink. This is where hockey in Newark started in 2003, an after-school program where kids ages 6 to 18 can learn and play hockey for free.
We have a unique population in terms of our enrollment.
Mike Liu is one of the coaches.
We have kids that come from all different parts of the world. Some are Spanish-speaking or Portuguese-speaking first, and then they're learning English. We have some kids in the program that are now joining that, you know, are fresh from a different country that don't speak the English language. So we're seeing a lot of different kids that probably don't fit the bill of what a typical ice hockey player in North America looks like.
By January 2016, the program grew from hockey in Newark to hockey in New Jersey. Much of the success, Liu says, came from the support of the parents. He recalls their first championship game in 2012.
this arena that night was packed, and parents have their air horns, or they have signs, and they're cheering, they're chanting, and you don't really see that in a middle school hockey game.
Some of the parents had just immigrated 6 months earlier.
A lot of them, it was probably their first game going to that year, and to see that kind of support for a non-traditional sport, probably from where they came from 6 months earlier, you know, kind of propelled these kids, obviously, to win that championship, but make it that much more special.
The program's graduates have carried that special feeling into adulthood. At the age of 13, Kevin Lopez was one of those Newark rink rats. He went on to play for the Princeton Club hockey team. Now, at 22, he credits his hockey community roots.
Being a part of one of the few all-minority hockey teams, or if not the only all-minority hockey team in the state of New Jersey, we had a lot to live up to. And hockey, at least the rink, gave us a platform to show, you know, there's so many stereotypes about people from Newark or people from urban, you know, from cities. But here we are, you know, we are playing against you on a somewhat even field, and we're beating you at your own game.
I've often wondered, how does sports play a role in making immigrants feel more at home in their adopted country? I think maybe it's not about feeling more American or Canadian. It's about feeling less like an outsider. The kids in hockey in Newark are getting to feel that. And just like Hockey Night in Canada Punjabi helps families feel like they're part of one big fan community, now there's this.
Jimmy Kay, golazo de los Florida Panthers, rugen las panteras en el BB&T Center, y esto se pone 1-0.
It sounds like soccer, but that's a broadcast for Spanish-speaking fans of the Florida Panthers. The Chicago Blackhawks have a Spanish broadcast, too. There are lots of immigrant kids who are sharing this experience now, one that helps them feel like they belong. And maybe there are even kids in clubs like Newark Hockey who dream of one day taking to the ice in the NHL, or as a member of an Olympic hockey team. For Here and Now, I'm Shagana Ehampram.
And Shagana's story comes to us from Feet in Two Worlds, a project at the New School in New York that brings stories by immigrant journalists to public radio. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.